Thank you. We're going to go on to case number 2, which is 083219, and it's Kenseth versus Dean Health Plan. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lisa Goldman, and I represent the appellant Deborah Kenseth. This case is about whether fiduciaries are obligated to give binding coverage decisions before costs are incurred when a participant requests the decision. The correct standard of review to apply to a breach of fiduciary duty claim, an ERISA estoppel claim, or a violation of state law claim is de novo, as all are questions of law, not fact. This court should reverse the district court's grant a summary judgment in favor of Dean and instead grant summary judgment in favor of Kenseth for three reasons. First, fiduciary duty principles should control when deciding if a health insurance company should be liable for a misleading plan that contains contradictory procedures for obtaining binding benefit determinations. Second, summary judgment should be granted in favor of Kenseth on her estoppel claim, as Dean reduced its oral representation to writing, negating many of the policy reasons behind the well-settled rule that oral modifications will not modify written ERISA plans. Third, summary judgment should be granted in favor of Kenseth on her ERISA state law claim, as Dean has admitted its plan discriminated against Kenseth on the basis of a pre-existing condition or her prior medical history.
Now, Ms. Goldman, can you clarify for me your understanding of what Dean's practice was as to seeking pre-certification that a particular surgery or treatment was covered? I looked at the proposed fact findings that you submitted to Judge Crabb on that point and at Dean's response. You say there was no procedure in place, but Dean said that physicians could seek written authorization. Now, was that set forth anywhere in that plan language?
There was none of the language that Dean, if I understand your question correct, Judge Rovner, the plan itself has written all over it, and the plan handbook has written all over it, that if you want benefit questions answered, you call customer service. There is a specific provision in the plan for someone whose doctor is not a plan provider or where the facility where the procedure is going to take place is not a plan facility. Those particular participants have to obtain prior authorization or prior certification before benefits will be granted to those participants. However, Dean testified in depositions, both by the customer service representative, Supervisor Ms. Paskey, and by their appeals representative, that Dean does not have a procedure for a participant to obtain a binding benefit determination before costs are incurred when the procedure will be performed by a plan provider in a plan facility, which is in direct opposition to the actual written language of their plan. Which brings me to my first point, Your Honor, which is that a breach of fiduciary duty first requires that Dean is a fiduciary, that they breached their duty, and it was to Kenseth's harm. Dean conceded it owed a fiduciary duty to Kenseth, and the law places that duty on Dean in order to protect participants just like Ms. Kenseth. Had Dean created procedures in their plan that were clearly understood, Kenseth could have had a binding predetermination of benefits decision before she incurred the costs of this procedure. The result in this case is simply unfair and unjust, Your Honors, as Kenseth was completely without any of the information she needed to make a decision on whether or not she should follow through with surgery on December 6, 2005 with Dr. Hoopenbecker.
Now, the plan in this case contained a provision stating that no oral representation could modify the coverage of exclusions of the policy. How does that affect her equitable estoppel claim, given that her claim relies on oral representations?
Your Honor, to substantiate an equitable estoppel claim in the Seventh Circuit, Ms. Kenseth must show that there's a knowing misrepresentation, that it was in writing, and that Ms. Kenseth reasonably relied on it to her detriment. And unless the plan is ambiguous, an oral representation cannot be used to substantiate an ERISA estoppel claim. Here, however, the plan is ambiguous and misleading in two ways. Moreover, Dean reduced its oral representation to writing in their track system because they confirmed that they told her the procedure was covered, which negates the policy reasons behind not allowing an oral representation to modify a plan. This court has historically refrained from allowing an oral representation because they don't want a swearing match at trial, and the insurance company would be disadvantaged because their customer service rep might be talking to 50 people in one day and not remember the exact conversation, what she said, what the other person said, and they're completely disadvantaged at trial. However, here, this oral misrepresentation was reduced to writing. Dean wrote in their track system that they confirmed benefits for the procedure on December 6, 2005, by Dr. Hoopenbecker at St. Mary's Hospital. So that negates a lot of the policy reasons behind not allowing an oral misrepresentation.
When you refer to, I guess it was a preferred provider and a preferred facility or whatever, you said, I think something like plan provider, plan facility?
Correct.
Does that mean they're approved, pre-approved, at least as the word I know is preferred provider. That's the one I run into. So is that what that is?
I believe the answer to your question is yes, Your Honor. Dean Healthcare has a set of doctors that are Dean doctors, and Dr. Hoopenbecker was one of those doctors, and they have a set of facilities that they regularly use for their plan providers to conduct their work, and no, St. Mary's is a plan facility.
Would a doctor in these situations, I think a doctor wants to get paid as well as the patient wants the insurance company to pay for it. Do they contact or do they try to get some kind of approval to make sure, is that when a preferred provider gets something like this? It seems to be the problem, they argue, is that, yes, whatever, tell me what the actual thing was, the thing with the esophagus, whatever they were doing, the actual operation as opposed to what it was repairing.
If I understand your question correctly, what's going to happen in this case is Dr. Hoopenbecker performed the surgery.
What is it? What's the surgery called?
A root revision of proximal gastric stenosis or a Roux-en-Y stenosis. Basically, what he did is he created a pouch at the bottom of Ms. Kenseth's esophagus, and he connected that pouch to her lower intestine. 20 years ago, Ms. Kenseth's stomach was like all of our stomachs if they've never had any operation on them. They punched a hole in her stomach 20 years ago. They stapled one side of her stomach closed. They put a band at the hole, and eventually over time, tissue grew inside the band, constricting the hole. On several occasions, Ms. Kenseth had a balloon inserted where the band is. It expanded the band. That's called a dilation, and Dean paid for those procedures. At this point, Dr. Hoopenbecker decided what we should do is build a pouch above the band at the bottom of your esophagus and just go around your whole stomach and not even use your stomach at all anymore. That's the procedure that was performed. And Dean's standard practice, Dean doctors like Dr. Hoopenbecker, is to give the participant in that situation a standard ambulatory form, which is in the record, and that form tells the participant to call customer service to make sure you have coverage for this procedure. Now that customer service has denied coverage for Dean, Dr. Hoopenbecker is fully allowed to go after Ms. Kenseth for the costs of that procedure as a Dean provider.
Well, now, I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand it, because Dean is saying they were not aware that this was fix a breakdown in what had previously been an operation to cure, we'll call it, morbid obesity. And those are specific exclusions in here. And they say, well, they didn't. They thought this was an isolated operation for whatever it was immediately doing, as opposed to relating back to the morbid obesity operation that they wanted to remedy.
I think what you're asking me, Your Honor, if I may rephrase the question, is did Ms. Kenseth have a duty to tell the customer service representative that she had had gastric banding surgery 20 years earlier?
Well, this was a problem with that operation, and it was a breakdown in whatever happened, and this was to remedy it, the breakdown of the previous remedy, I'll call it.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor.
I'm not talking very well on this.
It's okay. I think I understand what you're saying. Dean created a plan that told participants to call customer service. Dean knew that Kenseth would rely on the representation she was given by the customer service representative, and Dean knew that it was an oral representation, and they could argue later that they wouldn't be bound by it. Dean's failure to tell Kenseth, either through their customer service representative or through their written plan, that Dean wouldn't be bound by the representations of customer service representatives is a misrepresentation in itself, as it's in direct conflict with the plan that tells participants to call customer service. Now Dean is saying that the plan is not ambiguous, but it's also ambiguous because the morbid obesity exclusions that are found on page 14 and 21 say we don't cover surgeries related to morbid obesity. No one would connect those exclusions with the general exclusion found on page 33 that says we don't cover services related to non-covered services, particularly Ms. Kenseth, as at the time she received this surgery, she only weighed between 120 and 130 pounds. She hadn't been morbidly obese in 20 years.
One more thing.
Sure.
But the district court, as you know, went through a very methodical analysis of the contract and how it was written and the various language in it. And you say, well, yeah, but this was on page 40 and something else is on page 40 or 33, and you had to connect the dots in order to do what Judge Crabb did. But that's what she did. She's lamenting along the way, say this is too bad, but here's what the contract says. So while you're saying your way around the contract is to say it's ambiguous, I guess.
I believe it is ambiguous. I don't think anybody reading the plan would connect the morbid obesity exclusions on page 14 and 21 with the non-covered exclusion on page 33, particularly Kenseth, because at the time she had her morbid obesity surgery, it was a covered benefit under her plan through her employer at that time. So she called customer service, which is what anybody would have done because that's what the plan told her to do. She called customer service to get a determination, and they never told her in the plan or on the phone, by the way, you can't rely on the information we're giving you today. This court has already stated in Schmidt v. Sheet Metal Workers, National Pension Fund, a decision authored by Judge Rovner, that a fiduciary can breach their duty by failing to train their customer service representatives appropriately. Dean doesn't get to create a plan that sends everybody to customer service for an oral determination and then not train their customer service representatives to tell participants that they can't rely on the decisions they're given.
Can I try something to this? When she spoke with the customer service representative, am I correct in understanding that she was consulting the written instructions that Dr. Hoopenbecker had given her?
She was consulting that, correct. And when she...
And did that instructions form say anything about her stenosis being a complication of her 1987 gastric band surgery?
That form, I see that my time for rebuttal.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Lady Bountiful is here today.
Thank you. The form that Dr. Hoopenbecker gave her told her it was her responsibility to check on coverage and she should check on coverage. It was a standard form. The only portions of the form that had any handwriting on it was the bottom of the form where Dr. Hoopenbecker's nurse hand wrote, this is what you tell customer service, rue revision of proximal gastric stenosis. And what Kenseth testified that she told the customer service representative was she was having a rue and Y stenosis, surgery. She also testified that she had read the plan on multiple occasions and that she last read it in November, but she didn't remember reading certain provisions that Attorney Rotier asked her if she had read. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Ms. Rotier.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm Kathy Rotier, and I'm pleased to be here today to offer arguments on behalf of Dean Health Plan, Inc. Dean is one of the three or four large HMOs through which most people in Madison, Wisconsin, and South Central Wisconsin get their health insurance coverage. In this particular case, Dean is being sued by its subscriber, Deborah Kenseth, who says that she didn't get benefits to which she was entitled under the policy. So the very first thing you need to do is look at the policy and see if, in fact, the benefits she's claiming entitlement to are, in fact, covered. They are not. She is asking for coverage for surgery that relates to prior treatment of morbid obesity. And the Dean policy is very clear. This is a large booklet, I will tell you that. It's 51 pages, but it covers a whole HMO network, and it tries to cover the waterfront on just about everything. And I suspect that each of you has a health insurance policy of equal length if you look at it.
I'm curious about the prior dilations or whatever they're called where the expansion was made for the entry, and that was paid for by Dean.
There was one in 2004. That's the only one that is shown by any admissible evidence in this record. And that was paid for by Dean. It was not highlighted. It was not red flagged. I don't think, however, Your Honor, that that sets up, well, if you paid for it there, that must mean if you made a mistake one time, you are bound to continue the mistake forever.
But that surgery was needed because of the banding. It was a complication
with
comps or kind of almost a natural thing that happens once you have the banding done?
Well, I would hope not, or they would never do the banding in the first place. But it is a complication that can arise many years after a banding procedure that's used for treatment of morbid obesity.
And it's pretty clearly directed to the morbid obesity prior treatment.
Absolutely. So you have the Dean policy that says what are non-covered services, and it lists on two separate pages, non-covered services include any surgery or treatment for morbid obesity, and then you look at other non-covered services, and it says any services or treatment related to a non-covered service.
So what I'm having trouble with as a fiduciary, Dean in 2004 pays for that surgery, which is clearly related to the prior stomach banding, and then this comes along and the plan participant calls as indicated in the policy and the directions from the doctor and is told that it's paid for and the notations are made. As a fiduciary, is Dean fulfilling its responsibilities?
Absolutely. Dean did fulfill its duty as a responsibility as a fiduciary, and let me explain. There is a lot of case law in this circuit on estoppel claims under ERISA, under breach of fiduciary claims under ERISA. They have essential elements. A plaintiff who seeks to make a claim under one of those standards has to prove all of them. First of all, for a breach of fiduciary claim, you have to have not vicarious liability based on what a clerical employee said, but something that is attributable to the plan fiduciary itself. You don't have that here. You have to have a duty that was allegedly breached. In her argument, Ms. Goldman said there was nothing that Deborah Kenseth could have looked at to determine whether or not this particular surgical procedure would be covered. What that ignores is that she had the policy. She had the policy that said any coverage for morbid obesity is not covered and any complications, anything related to treatment of morbid obesity is not covered.
She had that same policy in 2004. Excuse me for interrupting, but she had that same policy in 2004, and it did cover something that's directly related, would not have to have been done unless the stomach had been stapled previously.
Your Honor, what I would offer you in that connection is it seems like you're saying that there's some sort of an estoppel. If you made a mistake once, if you didn't catch it once, if it wasn't flagged once, then you are forever bound to pay for non-covered services thereafter. I don't think that's true, and I would point you to the Coker case, a 1999 decision of this court, in which Susan Coker, in that case, got free, essentially free health insurance coverage under which she had numerous procedures that were paid for. That didn't entitle her to be able to say, hey, you made a mistake, you can't correct it, you can't now assert that there is no coverage. When Ms. Kenseth called customer service on November 15th, Ms. Kenseth then knew, because she had talked to her care providers about it, that the procedure they were talking about doing related back and was needed because of a complication of the prior morbid obesity surgery. When she spoke to the dean customer service representative, she didn't tell her that. She left that fact out. And that's what led to what, if it's a misrepresentation at all, is entirely an innocent misrepresentation in this case, and it does not give rise to a breach of fiduciary duty claim under Vallone, under Fram, under Kampanen, under a whole line of Seventh Circuit cases.
The customer service representative had access to these prior treatments that had been approved.
Probably not when a person is just calling on the phone like that.
Shouldn't you train your customer service representatives to be alert to such things, particularly in these types of surgeries? There are red flags all over this.
In a perfect world, sure. But
fiduciaries are held to a pretty perfect world.
Well, except when the fiduciary has in its policy the statement, clear and unequivocal, that oral statements cannot change, modify, improve, or decrease benefits.
But if you
that
have any
statement is part of the contract.
It has numerous times, more times actually in the policy, if you have any questions, call this number.
I think if you actually looked at the policy, what Ms. Goldman is referring to several times is the handbook. If you look at the policy, you will see one statement at the bottom of page 7, and Ms. Kenseth said in her own deposition that she never read the statement on the bottom of page 7.
Your handbook is your summary plan description, I assume, isn't it?
The handbook is a description for members. We are not the plan administrator. We are the health part of a employee benefit plan of Highsmith, Inc., which is the employer of Ms. Kenseth. And we are the claims administrators. We provide the health insurance benefits pursuant to a policy that we produce and that we administer. That's correct.
You have no connection with the summary plan description.
The summary plan description, as I'm understanding ERISA, is a responsibility of the employer who is putting together an employee benefit plan that could include life insurance and retirement and could include a lot of things. But with respect to our health insurance, we issue this group member certificate that I talked about, which is a 51-page document that is provided and is available to all members.
Let me tell you my problem. I don't know how it would be clear to the average non-lawyer that the related to language was broad enough to encompass complications that were that occurred many years after the original non-covered surgery. I mean, she didn't require corrective surgery until 18 years later.
Your Honor, in response to that, I would direct your attention to the Carr case. It's a case decided by this court. It's a case in which Janet Carr had surgery to correct previous surgery for gastric resection for morbid obesity 16 years before. It had language in the policy much less clear than the Dean language, and the court upheld the administrator's decision to deny coverage because the need for the current surgery was related to and was a complication of the earlier surgery. It's exactly on point.
Can you explain to me what, if any, procedure Dean had in place that a plan participant could use to seek pre-authorization or confirmation for a forthcoming surgery? Because in your response to Ms. Kenseth's proposed facts below, you said that physicians could seek prior written confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Could she herself had sought written confirmation, or would Dr. Hoopenbecker have been the one to seek that?
Either one could have, but I think...
But he was part of your preferred network.
Right, and I think it's maybe important to understand the relationships. Dean Health Plan is a separate corporation. It's the insurance arm. It doesn't employ Dr. Hoopenbecker or any other doctors, but there is a network of doctors. It's an HMO who perform services and who are sort of, their services are arranged for to provide the overall care of health of the participants in the HMO. Now, to get to your question, you wanted to know whether or not either the subscriber or the doctors could call and ask, could write and ask. Any of those things could have happened. I think Ms. Goldman's point is that there's nothing in the certificate itself that says, here is number 123, the method for getting that kind of written approval.
And that's my question. Whether the certificate itself ever explains where and how a participant can seek written confirmation of coverage for a particular surgery or treatment.
It does not have that for services that are performed within the plan. When I asked Ms. Kenseth at her deposition, however, whether she, if this was an important issue to her, did she think just write a letter or ask them to send you an email or ask for anything that would be a written confirmation that she wanted? And she said it just never occurred to her.
Well, I can understand that under these circumstances. Given cases like Bowerman, if you're inviting plan participants to call your toll-free number with questions about coverage and the relevant plan language is not only unclear as to coverage, but it doesn't tell you where you can seek written confirmation, why shouldn't a participant justifiably rely on what the customer service representative tells her?
Well,
and this customer service representative never said to her, now tell me, is this related to anything that occurred in the past? I mean, where's the clear path for plan participants and beneficiaries to follow in seeking confirmation whether a particular treatment is excluded from coverage or not?
The clearest path is to read the policy, and with due respect, Your Honor, I would disagree with your assertion that there's a confusion here. It says, if you look at the policy, and it's in the record at Record Entry 25, it's an attachment to an affidavit. In that policy, it'll have a column that says, you pay, and then it says 100% right next to any treatment relating to morbid obesity, and right next to the column that says any service or treatment related to a non-covered service. That tells a reasonable person reading that there is not coverage for treatment of complications that relate to a non-covered service, which specifically includes treatment for morbid obesity. And Ms. Kenseth admits that she full well knew that this presenting problem in 2005 was related to her prior morbid obesity treatment because her doctors had told her that. That's the fact that she didn't convey. And where does the subscriber get information? Well, you have to read the policy. And she didn't read the portions of the policy on even calling in to the customer service number or about oral representations. I would really ask the court to look at the case law that I have cited in the brief that indicates that an innocent misrepresentation cannot be the basis of a breach of fiduciary duty claim where there's no intent to deceive. And there's absolutely no evidence of that in this case. That is the Vallone case.
But it certainly did deceive. It deceived. All you had, you have cited no provision in the plan that alerted her to the fact that she could have sought written authorization. What you had was this toll-free number. When she calls, she's told it's covered. I think the incorrect information that, you know, the lady on the telephone gave simply highlights the problem with the ambiguity of the plan language and Dean's failure to have a procedure in place for confirmation of coverage. It just doesn't seem very fair.
Your Honor, again, I would just simply, I'm having a disconnect here because I've read the case law on breach of fiduciary duty claims and estoppel claims, and they are so on point, and they are so strong in saying that you cannot have a breach of fiduciary claim on these facts, and you can't have an estoppel claim on these facts. You can't have an estoppel claim, clearly, because there's no written misrepresentation.
Bowerman at 226 F3rd at 588-90 on the equitable estoppel question.
Does it matter, Your Honor, whether the policy itself actually covers the surgery?
I would say that if an individual can't tell that from the policy itself, then the answer would be no.
I see my
Well, you can talk.
I can keep on talking. Okay, I'm not getting anywhere, but I'll keep trying.
You never know. You know, we go out there and
I
might be beaten to death by these two.
Because I have one.
Yes,
you want to answer something?
No, go ahead, Your Honor.
You brought up the fact that she didn't fully disclose. She only said partially what the operation was and didn't say that it related back or however she was supposed to. What did she say and what did she not say?
What she said is actually quoted in the brief. I asked her at deposition to try to recollect as best she could the contents of what she said and what the other person said. And she, I'm not going to be able to quote it verbatim here, but basically she said, reconstruction of the esophagus because of all the reflux I've been having.
Okay, and what did she not say that she should have said?
She didn't say, and I've been talking to my doctors, and they say this results from the gastric bypass surgery I had 18 years ago or however many years ago when I had morbid obesity treatment. She said nothing about prior surgery or morbid obesity or the fact that she had a band in her stomach, none of that.
And as far as the, I guess, burden, is there anything here about the fiduciary obligation and some kind of an arbitrary and capricious decision?
Yeah, and that is a really important point because the arbitrary and capricious standard that relates and applies to denial of benefit claim says that if the claim administrator who has discretion, and clearly Dean does in this circumstance have discretion, if that administrator's decision is not completely unreasonable, that is, it has any indicia of reasonableness, it will be upheld. And the decision Dean made in this case, I think, is perfectly reasonable. I really do believe if you look at that policy and you look at the column saying you pay 100%, that tells the person that is not covered. It's not covered if it's any treatment or services that relates to a non-covered service, and that includes any treatment for morbid obesity.
This esophageal reconstruction and the bypass and so forth, what you contend keeps it from being covered under this policy is the relation to. It's not the surgery itself. This is not unique to those who've had their stomach stapled.
Right. You could have stomach cancer. You could have some other mechanism that created the problem. But obesity surgery in today's world, where obesity is becoming a bigger and bigger and bigger health issue, is a very big dollar item. It's a big ticket item. Many insurance policies do not cover it.
The only way it's not covered under the policy is if it's related to the morbid obesity treatment that preceded it.
in this case. If it was, I mean, there might be some other non-covered service that I'm not aware of that might trigger, but here the reason is because it's related to morbid obesity. That's exactly the fact situation I would tell you that's in the Carr case and in another Seventh Circuit decision called Mandy.
And the customer service rep was not trained to ask the question, is this related to some prior morbid obesity treatment?
To my knowledge, that's not part of the record, but to my knowledge, no.
Okay. That's all I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I just have a couple of points to make on rebuttal, Your Honors. First of all, there was some discussion about document 25-2, the plan, and I have it with me, and I would just like to read for the court so there's no dispute that the exclusion for morbid obesity found on page 14 is under inpatient hospitalization. And it's number 4, any surgical treatment or hospitalization for the treatment of morbid obesity. The next morbid obesity exclusion is found on page 21, and that simply says under outpatient physical, speech, occupational, surgical services, any surgical treatment or hospitalization for the treatment of morbid obesity. There's nothing on either of those pages that talk about non-covered services. We don't get to non-covered services until we get to page 33, where it just simply says on page 33, at the very top, general exclusions and limitations continued, number 28, services or supplies related to a non-covered service, denied referral, or prior authorization, or denied admission. How someone reading this plan is going to connect the exclusions on page 14 and 21 with the exclusion on page 33 is beyond me, particularly someone who has no prior experience in contract interpretation and who's simply looking for an answer on whether she's going to have to pay almost $80,000 for a surgery that she could hold off having until she knows she's under a plan that will cover it. With regard, the defendant asserted that Dean is not bound by the decisions of a ministerial employee. They're bound by the decisions of the customer service representative in this case because their plan specifically gives their fiduciary responsibilities to their customer service representatives when they tell them, if you have any benefit questions, call our customer service reps. That in the plan itself, there are several pages where they specifically say, if you want information on maximum allowable fees, call customer service. If you want information on this, that, or the other, call customer service. If you don't have a binding determination in writing and you're getting ready to go in, call customer service. For example, page 5 says, you may obtain information about maximum allowable fees prior to having a service performed. Ask your provider for the procedure code and the amount the provider will charge. Then call our customer service department and request information regarding maximum allowable fees. Within 5 days of receiving your request, we will notify you whether the service is covered and if it's subject to any plan provisions. They've clearly given their discretionary authority to their customer service representatives. This isn't a case about...
Ms. Goldman, did you argue a training theory at the district court, inadequate training of the customer service rep?
Yes, Your Honor. Our brief does argue that they failed to train, it's particularly the reply brief, they failed to train their customer services to tell the participant you can't count on what we say. They failed to put in the plan itself that you can't count on what a customer service representative says, and they failed to put anywhere in the plan, if you want a predetermination decision, here's the person you write to, here's their name, here's their title, here's their address. They tell you today that she should have written Dean and asked for a decision. If I was going to write Dean and ask for a decision, I could read this 10 times over again, and I wouldn't know who to write or where to write. Moreover, they said they're not the plan administrator. They said they're only the claims administrator. ERISA specifically states under 29 U.S.C. 1022 summary plan description, the summary plan description shall contain the following information: the name and type of administration of the plan, and then it goes on. It says the name and address of such insurer, the name and address of the person designated as the agent,
for service of legal process. If that person is not the administrator, the name and address of the administrator, names, title, and addresses of any trustee or trustees, if the person are different from the administrator. When we look at the plan and we see who's listed on the plan, the only one listed on the plan as the administrator is Dean. That's it. So for them to come here today and say, without arguing in the court below or establishing a factual basis to argue, that they're not the plan administrator is disingenuous. There's nothing in the record that says they're not a fiduciary. They don't have the authority to administer the plan. There's nothing in the record that supports that contention. When I see my time has expired.
You finish your thought, of course.
Okay. Last thing I wanted to say is with regard to Carr, Carr specifically states that the woman had gastric banding surgery. She had a modification of the surgery. The plan didn't cover it. She appealed the decision, and the plan decided to cover it. And then they sent her a letter and said, if you have any more complications related to this, we will not cover it. She had a subsequent complication related to it. They didn't cover it. She appealed the decision. They denied it again. And then she went up on appeal, and the court said, no, they told you it wasn't going to be covered. You had it anyway. It's not going to be covered. Those facts are completely different from the facts in this case. Ms. Kent said it had absolutely no warning that this wouldn't be covered. She had absolutely no warning that there was no procedure to obtain a prior benefit determination. And she had no way of avoiding an $80,000 bill based on this plan. In conclusion, Your Honor, Ms. Kenseth respectfully requests this court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Dean and instead grant summary judgment in favor of Kenseth on her breach of fiduciary duty claim, her ERISA estoppel claim, and her violation of state law claim. Thank you.
Now, someone dropped something. Okay. Well, thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.